the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Okay, it is so lovely to be back with you all tonight and to keep exploring the book of Exodus together. As Claire really helpfully pointed out before she read the passage, it's really important that we know what comes before what we just read as well. That this passage is actually part of one of the most famous parts, certainly of Exodus, if not of the whole Bible. That Moses and the burning bush is the setting, is the background for this conversation. That this is still part of, in fact, the conversation that I think establishes a personal relationship between Moses and God in an extraordinary way. So with that in mind tonight, I'd like to talk about questions, and I guess also kind of about unexpected answers. For most of you, I imagine, and I kind of hope, that you are used to asking a question and receiving a corresponding answer most of the time. In my day job, that's not quite as true. Most of my conversations are between me and six-year-olds, so they tend to have a little bit less of a, let's say, a linear conversational style. Questions like, what do you need to do now, can elicit answers about pet cats, about parents, about what the moon may or may not be made out of that day. It can be a little bit of a wild ride at times. And in many ways, this is superficially how Moses and God's conversation feels in verses 11 and 12. The question Moses asks is, who am I to go and do what you have said? The answer, I will be with you. The answer doesn't seem to fit the question that Moses asked. Now, like in many of my interactions, was God staring out of the window? Was he thinking about what might be for lunch or mulling what his favourite dinosaur was that day? I don't think so. God, I think, answers the question that Moses should have asked, not the question that he did. Not who am I to go and do this, but who are you who are sending me to do it? And I think, certainly personally, when I hear titles for talks like tonight's, God Calls a Leader, it's really easy for our first instinct to be very similar to Moses' starting point. That our thoughts jump to questions like, what is it about this leader that means that they are called? How will this leader respond? What are they going to go on to do? But we've got it the wrong way round. It's not the object of the sentence that we need to think about primarily, but the subject. When my phone rings and I see the name pop up, my focus isn't, or at least shouldn't be, on the fact that my mum, my friend, my gran, my boss, whoever, is calling me, but that they are calling. It's the caller who is important. And similarly, it isn't first and foremost about who Moses is. Not even about why he is being called and what he's being called to do, but about who is calling. God here calls a very broken leader, a coward, a murderer, an orphan, an exile. We aren't supposed, I don't think, to put ourselves in the shoes of Moses here, or to want to be him, to want to be that leader. we're supposed to be able to look beyond this example of broken, transformed humanity to the God of transformation, the God who speaks and acts and saves. So tonight, I only want to ask one question. Who is it that is calling? Who is calling Moses? And who is calling us? This is a passage that is filled with clues and pointers to the character and the identity of the God who is calling. When Moses asks in verse 13 for the name of the God who is sending him, he's fundamentally asking, who are you? It's a pretty good question to ask a God who's talking through a burning bush. Who are you? And as Richard touched on last week, Moses came from a culture where the name that you were given told something of you and your family's story. It gave everybody who met you a clue, an insight into who you were. And that is what Moses is asking. But again, we kind of return to the six-year-old style of question and answer here. Moses says, what is your name? And God's reply is at best an interesting one. It's somehow simultaneously both very simple and incredibly complex. God's response to the question, who are you? What is your name? Is, I am who I am. I am has sent me to you. That is what he is to tell the Israelites. I am has sent me. I'd love to know what Moses was thinking when that's the answer he got to the question, what is your name? I really don't think that that's what he was expecting. If it was me, I think my response would be, great, thanks, can we try that again? But what does the answer that God gives tell Moses about who God is? What does it tell us? I think it actually says quite a lot. In that one sentence, I am who I am, is encapsulated the fact that unlike every human, God is utterly self-defining. He announces who he is and what he is like. He is utterly self-sufficient and self-sustaining. I am who I am is all that he needs to say. So who is calling? Who's calling Moses? Who is calling us? Well, I am is calling. And God doesn't stop there in explaining who he is to Moses. Next, God tells some of the story of his history with the Israelites. The passage tells us that God says, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. For Moses and the Israelites, and I guess for many of us, these were very familiar stories of God's faithfulness, of God's provision. And God is highlighting to Moses and the Israelites that the same God who was at work in the lives of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob is at work in their lives. The same God who shared who he was with their forefathers is waiting to share who he is with them. The first thing that God told us in this passage about who he is like a name. It's personal. This second part shows us that God and his name are not only personal, but also covenantal. that the promises that God has made to his people will be fulfilled just as they were before. They paint a picture of a God who has built a past and a story with these people. And more than that, not only is there shared past history between the Israelites and God, but he shows that there will continue to be. Verse 15 continues, this is the name that they will use from generation to generation. And in verse 17, God continues to set out actually a very clear point by point plan, sounds a bit like a roadmap, as to what will happen as a result of him calling Moses. This is a God who not only spoke to their ancestors, but also has clear plans for the future of his people. That whatever may change, God will still be the same. That in our lives, whatever may change, God will still be the same. His name will still be true of him, and he will still be in relationship with his people. So who is calling? Well, the God of your fathers, the unchanging God, is calling. And I can see how it would be very easy for the Israelites and for us to arrive at the conclusion that any God who is utterly self-defining, self-sustaining, and completely unchanging must be a far-off God. Those attributes are so far from our lived human experience that any God like that would surely want nothing to do with us. But the next part of his character that God chooses to reveal here shows us that the opposite is true. The passage continues, the Lord, the God of their fathers, has watched over them and has seen their misery in Egypt. The God who is far above and far beyond what we are and what we can imagine is also engaged and interested. He has watched his people. He has cared for his people. He has seen their misery. In those times when we feel like this is a distant God, a God who surely wants nothing to do with me, we can also be sure that this is a God who watches and sees our joy and also our misery. And not only are we shown here that this God who is calling is present, but also that he is acting. He doesn't only see the misery, but he's ready to act and free them from it. Much of the rest of this passage is a kind of foreshadowing of the plagues that will come to Egypt, which we'll be looking at in more detail in a few weeks. And for that reason, and because I'd only be able to kind of skim the surface of it, I'm not going to spend any time now focusing on the importance of them as symbols. That will come because they all come back up again. Instead, what is important for us tonight is their place as demonstrations of the power and the involvement of God. The staff that becomes a snake, the hand that is leprous and then cured, the water of the Nile are not magic tricks, they're not Moses's party pieces that God presents him with. They're not even confirmations of Moses's authority and success as a leader called by God. But rather, they are confirmations of who God is and what he is doing. It's helpful because God tells us their purpose, and who better to tell us what they're for? The purpose God tells us is so that the Israelites may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, has appeared to you. It's not about Moses' power. It's not about Moses' status. It's so that the Israelites may believe that he has met with God and that God has sent him. Every action that Moses takes here, every action that he'll take in the coming chapters, and there'll be a lot of them, and they will be big actions, but they shouldn't point to who Moses is. They should point to the glory of God and to the active role that he chooses to take in his creation. And it should be, and all too often, certainly for me, isn't the same for us. Every action that we take, the big, the small, the seemingly insignificant, the moments of glory, shouldn't point to ourselves, but to the glory of God. Why? Well, because who is calling? The present and active God is calling. Right in the middle of this passage, if you've got it open in front of you, it pretty much is smack bang in the middle. There is a blink and you'd miss it sentence. A sentence that not only tells us about who is calling, but why they are calling. The latter part of verse 18 of Exodus 3 reads, "The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God." This is what the Israelites are to ask for permission to go and do from Pharaoh. This simple request is what will lead to all that is to come. And it would be easy to miss it, but I think it holds two important truths for what we're talking about tonight. Moses, and in different ways the Israelites as a people, are being called to go and do something. But the call on their lives is not about increasing their self-confidence. It's not about increasing even their independence, even though it might feel like it when they talk about freedom. In fact, the exact opposite is true. All that happens here, all that they are being called to do, is designed to increase their reliance on God. They are called by God to go into the wilderness and worship him, to offer sacrifices to their unchanging, present, active God, because simply of who he is. So who is calling Moses? Who is calling the Israelites? Who is calling you? Well, the God who alone is worthy of worship is calling. I'm aware that tonight, kind of by definition, has been a bit of a whistle-stop tour. And this is a fabulous passage, an absolutely jam-packed one. And if you have some time this week, I would so encourage you to just sit with it for a while. It is filled with snippets of who God is and what he wants relationship with him to be like. And if you have the time, sit and spend some time with God and with this passage. But if you're anything like me, life will get busy very quickly. The alarm clock will go off tomorrow morning And it's a bit like the starting gun's been fired, and here we go again for the week. And equally, in the coming days, in the coming weeks, I know that I will have, and I'd be surprised if you didn't as well, moments when everything inside you, to be honest, just wants to scream at God the same question that Moses starts with. Who am I that I should go and do this? It's a really natural response to a lot of what is required of us. Who am I to go and do this? Please choose somebody else. And there are so many times when we just feel like we don't quite measure up. I wonder what it would look like if both individually and collectively we chose to know that this isn't about who is being called. It's not even entirely about what they're being called to do, but about who is doing the calling. That the unchanging, present, active God who is worthy of worship is the one who calls us by name. What if our lives were utterly based on the foundation that the unexpected right answer to the question, who am I that I should go and do this, is and always will be, I will be with you.